when he fled from Absalom, his son. So, okay, this is going to require a little backstory. This is the part that's like, oh, cool, you know, this is the part, pay attention to. This is the biblical history, the narrative of the story. David, everybody know who David was? I can see I got a lot of work to do. David was the king in Israel. And he was, if you've read some of his story, you'll know that he had what we would probably call today a dysfunctional family. Very dysfunctional. So, and now, as I say that, and I like to say this as often as possible, David was a terribly broken dude who God repeatedly says he was a man after God's own heart. So when you feel low or you feel bad or you feel shamed or you feel like you're just not good enough, I just want you to remember what you're about to learn about David. The big story, right? We all know the big story, standing out, looking. He should have been at work, and he wasn't. He's looking out the roof, and he sees this girl bathing, and he kills her husband, and gets her pregnant, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, he murdered the whole shebang. So he did all that. That didn't help his family dynamic at all. Had several wives. So this is David. Now, he has a son. He has several sons, several daughters, obviously. But here's what happens. I'm going to give you the short version. Absalom, his son, is angry at another son because this Absalom had a sister, Tamar, and the other son, you know, visited her at night. And she didn't like that and kind of shamed her in the process. And so Absalom gets mad and kills his brother. So that happens. And David's kind of upset, sends him away. They develop this very, very strange relationship, David and Absalom. You killed my other son, your brother. I don't want to see you. I don't want to talk to you. Things begin to get better. He lets Absalom come back to the city without killing him and all that. But then Absalom starts to sort of undermine David. We've all seen this, right? The second in command will say things like, he doesn't have time for you. Let me help. What can I do for you? That's exactly what Absalom did. Tells us in this whole story is in 2 Samuel. It tells us that Absalom would go out to the city gate, wait for people to come with problems, and he'd say, yeah, it's a shame that there's nobody to really take care of that, isn't it? Why don't you come talk to me? I'll take care of it. This is what Absalom did. And through doing this, he began to develop some support among people. And before you know it, he's taken over the kingdom, and David and his loyal followers are fleeing. They've left town. And they're in hiding. That's the backstory to this psalm. Now, one thing I want to mention is David is a model in many ways to us, God's people, of what we need to look to, we need to aim for. This is not just David. David is praying a prayer of lament, of sorrow. He's hurting. He's questioning, how's this all going to work out? What am I supposed to do? He's crying out to God. And in doing so, he's teaching us how to do it. So that's the backstory. I'm going to read it, and then we'll kind of talk through it a little bit. Starts out, Psalm 3, verse 1. Oh Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising up against me. Many are saying in my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, and the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of any thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. We pray. God, help us to know what this means in the process, even if we may come with foes. I pray. pray that you will help us to process this and allow us to see you meeting our needs even more. Amen. One thing I want to add, I just want to say, you know, what Sandra McCracken said there, I actually believe, this is my experience, I don't have data to prove this, but, you know, I've seen a lot of people sort of leave the church, and I don't mean for another, I mean leave the church, like, I don't know if I believe that, you know, and struggle, and that's fine, but from my experience, the main reason that I think in their stories seems to be that the church doesn't have answer for sorrow. Now, I don't believe it does, and I don't think that's the case here, but I do see a lot of, you know, sort of pop Christian culture. How are you? Right? How are we going to answer that question? How you doing? Everybody in here, I don't care if your mom died yesterday, you're going to answer that question, I'm good, thanks. That's the way we train, we're programmed to put on a happy face. And so when people come with legitimate sorrow, we want to stand up and shout and sing how wonderful life is, right? But there is very deep and rich treasure of sorrow in the Psalms. This is one of them. When David says this, many are my foes. Many are rising up against me. Last time we talked about this, we talked about how my soul and also my glory, both of which actually pop up in this verse, and how one ancient writer had said, this is, remember this we talked about? That there's this sort of innermost part of our being, and that's where we encounter the deepest fellowship with God. And yet we become distracted about everything all around and all of our stuff and problems. If we can get past that, we can connect more deeply. That was kind of the general tone of what we talked about. But that's another way to think about this. Many are saying to my soul, there's no salvation from God. God is not going to rescue that deep part of you. Cut off. And as I was kind of processing this, I'm like, what makes me feel that way? Right? I mean, there is a legitimate place here. I mean, this is very, just want to point out, very historical. Because you'll find that David's enemies actually said, God's not going to save him. God's abandoned him. This is what you get. They were saying that all the time in this moment. So that was actually true. But there's another part for us personally. You ever feel like that? You ever feel hopelessly lost? Like, you ever feel like, I can't be saved? Maybe you're not talking sort of eternal salvation when you say that, but have you ever felt like, I have? You ever been in that moment where you felt like, and this is never going to change. My life is just wrecked. All this terrible stuff is happening to me. It's just going to be this way. I know a lot of us here have felt that way. This is how David's feeling. I'm hopeless. I'm lost. I've got nothing. So what are the things? What are the things that we have? Think about it. What are your foes? They may be people. They may be actual people at work, at home, maybe even here, who you feel as though maybe they're your foes. I think one thing that we need to think about is whether foes are actual foes. Sometimes we perceive people as foes because they want to kill a part of us, right? We have this sort of proud exterior shell. And I have friends who I'll avoid if I know they're going to try to pierce that. They're not your foes. They might feel like it sometimes, but they're not. Those are the people that love you. But there are foes who would seek to attack you, bring you down. Maybe it's just, I mean, it could be money, it could be a job situation. It doesn't have to be a person. It could be a dog. What are your foes? Think about it. What is it that you bring? What's the heaviness? What is the weight that you bring to God? Bring it. You don't have to come to church. You don't have to come to God and say, you know, everything's good, thanks. And then he says, no. But you, O Lord, you're a shield about me, my glory. And I love this. One of my favorite verses in the Bible lately. The lifter of my head. I have just really come to hold on to this one line. You, Lord, are the lifter of my head. What are the things, I think we've talked about this recently because I've just been sitting in that myself. What are the things that we seek to lift our heads? Where do we go to feel better about ourselves when we're depressed? I have a friend who, trying to remember what she said, she struggles. Actually, you've met this friend of mine, Mandy. She came and spoke here a while back. Many of you might remember her, but she has some struggles with addiction, and she has this thing she says, halt. Some of you may have heard this. I don't know. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. That's her thing. And she's feeling that. She knows she's in trouble. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And when she's feeling that, what she's doing, and I think what we're all maybe doing, is we're looking for something to lift our head. We're struggling. We want to feel better. Where do we go? David's recognizing. I don't know that he feels better at this point, but he's admitting. He's confessing the truth. There's only one that can lift my head. It's the Lord. He is the one. And then this is interesting what he does here. Okay, he says, one thing I want to mention while we're in the Psalms, and this is a really good place because there's a word right here. Just so you know, this is kind of sidetracked, but it's important to know. There's a word in my version, you can probably see it in yours. I didn't believe it, it's me, my brother, I didn't say it. Salah. That's a Christian band, I think. Christian band? I think I'm sure it's where they get their name. Anyway, nobody really knows what it means. When you're reading a song, if you're reading through it, you can skip that word. It's probably a musical notation. The Psalms were originally written to be sung. There were songs sung in the assembly of people, and it's probably a musical sort of pause here. It's probably the best, you know, pause and reflect. Maybe play a musical interlude. That might even mean, might be interlude. What does interlude mean? Okay. Anyway, so we're not addressing that word any longer, but now you know what Salah is. So just skip it when you're reading songs. Or pause and reflect. That's not a bad idea. So what David does next is really cool. I lay down and slept. The Lord sustained me. I will not fear many thousands of people. So at first, right, as I'm journaling through and I'm working through this psalm and praying through it, I pause here, and if you really pause, if you think about this, this is what he says. Or we put it in modern language. I was walking down the street and I didn't stub my toe, so I know I'm not going to be decapitated. Seems to make sense, right? I lay down and slept. I woke again. The Lord sustained me. I will not fear many thousands of people. We call this the argument from the lesser to the greater. There's another common argument used more often in Scripture. It's the greater to the lesser. If God sent His own Son for us, surely will He not give us all things? The big thing, Jesus died for you, right? Surely. Everything else is going to take care of. That's the greater to the lesser. This is the lesser to the greater. And so at first, I'm processing that. I'm like, how does this kind of work? How does this work itself out? Doesn't really make sense. And so here's what I began to flip through and found in the story in 2 Samuel. When we read about it, what we find out is that so Absalom is chasing David. This is in chapter 17. I'm just going to give you the short version. As Absalom's chasing David, he gets some advice. Two different advisors come to him. One guy named Ahithophel. And he comes and he says, okay, here's what you need to do. He's going to be camped out for the night. Go hit him hard. I mean, hit him, you know, I'm going to just go whack, kill everybody. Right in the middle of the night. That's what I want you to do. That's Ahithophel. And then Hushai comes and he says, no, you don't want to do that. You want to wait for him to enter the city and then take the city and put the city under siege. Right? And this is what it says in verse 14. The Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to go in at night and kill everybody, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. See that? When David lay down and slept and woke again, it was because the Lord had ordained to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel. Ahithophel's advice, going at night, killing. But they didn't do that. Absalom said, no, we'll do what Hushai says. We'll go in and we'll make a siege. And so when David writes, I laid down and slept, the Lord sustained me. When he says that, he's actually looking at this reality that God has been kind and gracious and ordained that you might survive this. Ordained that Absalom would come to nothing. I think that's important. I think it's important for us to maybe to reflect on too. I lost my page. It's falling through. There you go. What are the little times, maybe even the insignificant, seemingly times, when God has been faithful to you? You know, in the midst of the sorrows, you're walking through the valley of the shadow of death, and you think, there's no salvation for me. How can it ever get any better, right? Think about this. What are the times that God has proven himself faithful to you? That's what David's doing here. He's going, no, you know what? God was faithful to me that my son didn't enter my camp last night and kill us all. So I'm not going to be afraid. God's got this. What are those times for you? For me? I think sometimes, for me, I reflect often on seminary life when we were dirt poor. I think my gross income 1 year was less than $8,000. It was rough. But you know what? Every month would go by and we'd be like, how do we pay the bills? I don't know. You know what I mean? Seriously, we would ask this question sometimes. We'd look at the numbers and go, where did that? It wasn't. But the bills were faithful. God was faithful. He was faithful with that. He was faithful with anything. If I can trust that whatever I encounter has been filtered through his fingers, I'm a man. That's what David is saying. And yet, so he's taken to rest in this reality. And this is what's interesting. In the story, his commander, Joab, comes to him and he's wanting to, you know, plan on a way to attack Absalom and all that. And David's like, no, be merciful. For my sake, be merciful to the man. Don't kill my son. They go to war. They actually do kill Absalom and dies. That's the story. Now, this is what I thought. How often do we come at our foes, whatever they may be, and we figure out a way to take them down? Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't act. David did act, but he acted out of mercy. His choice, his desire was mercy and gentleness and reconciliation, ultimately. That's where he was aiming. And yet he says this. In his willingness to wait, just like he did with Saul, years before, he'd been in the same situation with another king. Another man who set himself up as king. And he did, and he waited for God to deal with it. Look at what he says. I will wait. I will not fear. Arise, O Lord, and save me, O my God. It's not to go make a pro con list. It's not to start making those phone calls or networking. It's not to start drinking or looking at porn. That's not what he does. When he sits in that moment of agony and pain, he says, arise and save me, oh my God. I'm going to trust you. Just like Ian Steele in that song. Where else can I go? You're my only trust. You've all I've got. What else do we have? Sometimes it feels like nothing. And it is, except for God. That's all. So even if we feel like his ear is deaf to our cries, we just kind of keep going there and crying out to God, save me, oh my God. And then he says this, I love it. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Do you see this tie-in? David was a brilliant poet, a master artist, okay? Salvation belongs to the Lord. What did he say earlier? Many are saying to me, there's no salvation for him in God. It's not mine anyway. That's what David said. It's not mine. It belongs to God. He gives it to who he pleases. It's the Lord. You can't take it. My enemies can't take it. My foes can't take it. Nothing that stands against me can dare touch it. How dare you question that? He's reminding his heart. You know, in that moment, when you feel hopeless, I know some of you have been there. I've been there. Those moments where you just turn the headlights off going down the highway. Or just think about, I just had a spasm arm. Some of us have been there. Where we think there's no salvation from God. And when that moment comes for David, he says, no, no, no. Salvation belongs to the Lord. It's not mine either. My own heart can't take that away from me. It is God's. And it's resting secure in his hands. We have hope. 1 Thessalonians says we don't grieve people without hope. We can grieve, and we can grieve well, but we can do it with hope. Again, way to respond. What can we do? I'm going to encourage you again to journal, to pray through some Psalms, to really take the time, set aside the time, read Psalm 3, and then think through, how have I healed my foes? Work through this for yourself. You will not get anything from me telling you what this psalm means. But if you go home and you spend time, 30 minutes, tomorrow morning, just reading it, praying through it for you, how does God lift your head? How has he lifted your head in the past? Tell him. Journal. What are some areas you need, you know, right now to come and answer you? What is it you need? Come to God with that. One other thing I just want to share is kind of close. I was reading something the other day and I was like, wow, that's really cool. You know, sometimes, and I know some people, and I've heard this a lot because I love the Old Testament. You know that. And I've heard sometimes, you know, so much in the Old Testament, right? And I don't think a lot, but I've heard that sometimes. Feel that way. Let me tell you something. This is what I read and why I think it's so important that we go sit in that. Somebody had asked a question, or I can't remember how this came up in what I read, but here's what it said. The ancient Israelite, right, if you were to ask them their testimony, their story, how they've come to faith, right, just like we do in evangelical circles, you ask them and say, well, we were prisoners. I was a prisoner. I was a slave. I met the representative of God who came and told me I didn't have to be a slave anymore, set me free from slavery. We hid under the blood of the Lamb. And then we left slavery and we're on our way to a permanent home where God will bless us and we'll live in freedom, really, without anyone. And they said, you know what, I think the modern Christian would probably use the exact same words. We are those people. These prayers are our prayers. This book is our book. We are one people with one God, with one history and one home. And that's where we're headed. So no matter what it may feel like, we need to have the freedom to lament, to read and pray, to cry out in Psalms of lament, even while we hope and recognize that salvation is the Lord's forever. We pray for this. God, thank you. Thank you that yours is salvation, that you and you alone are King. That thank you for the history, the privilege of being able to read the poems and songs of King David as he struggled with hopelessness and fear and anxiety. anxiety. God, help us, not only help us to actually do that for ourselves, but I also pray that we would increasingly become the kind of place where people can come and do that, where we can cry out our anxieties and fears for our brothers and sisters here in this room and to you, and be honest about our hurts, and even together move toward hopefulness and a new home. It's in your name.